Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is the Gist of Freedom. You're listening to Leslie Gist, and I think we have Miss Bessie Coleman on the line.
It is said that when one answers death's call in mid-journey, that the doorway to eternal peace is found unopened. Restless, the spirit wanders in search of closure. It is from this belief that a dream to fly begins at the end of Bessie Coleman's earthly life. Her spirit rising to beg for answers. Did she live a life worth dying for? Bessie's spirit rises to question God and to speak to those who on this day can neither see nor touch her skin. They may only feel her presence. Is this it? It's over? My life is over? Why now? Why now when I'm so close to everything? All these years of moving around from place to place, all the traveling, I was finally settling in. So much struggle, for what? I don't understand. All I wanted, all I've ever truly wanted, was to make something of myself, to be someone, a person my people could be proud of. You made me this way. Why? I tried so hard. Was it worth it? This end, was it worth it? 3 memorial services in different states. Thousands and thousands of people standing in line to peer over my coffin to pay a last respect, to say goodbye, and yet not even 10 of them know who I am. All they know is what the newspapers have written about me, and most of that was my own creation to get attention. I was good at it. I wanted to get my people's attention. I wanted them to see themselves up there. They didn't know that. How can I rest in peace knowing that no one really knows me or what I tried to do, what I did? No, I can't. You have to give me more time. I need time. I need to share my story with someone, please. I need to know that my life had meaning, that others will go on after me. The dream, the future mustn't be lowered into the grave with my body. Lord, I need you to answer this question for me. Was learning to fly a worthy cause? Was it? I want to rest. I'm tired, but I can't rest until somebody knows. These people, these mourners at my gravesite, at least let me tell the people who came to say goodbye. Permission granted. Thank you. She speaks to the crowd at the gravesite. I have a question. How many of you have dreamed a special dream? A dream so powerful that it will not let you rest. Try as you may to shake it, it simply will not leave you alone. I had such a dream. I had a dream to fly that filled me with constant yearning. Sometimes I felt desperate and trapped by it. That's when I tell myself, Bessie, there's a hole in your soul. Fill it up. Fill it up. But there were hearts made of stone beating in the chest of those who was as determined to keep me from my dream as I was of getting to it. Imagine for a moment, if you will, that there is a shiny star visible before you. All of your secret joy, hope, and promises inside that shiny star. You reach your hand towards it, but somehow it always seems to be just slightly beyond your grasp. So you keep reaching and reaching and stretching and stretching. I know most of you know this feeling, right? You see it. It's so, so close. You know it's yours to have if only your arm were just a tiny bit longer, if only the star were just a little bit closer. You could hold that shiny star in the palm of your hand, and Lord, if only you could do that, then poof, magically everything you ever wanted to be, every wish you ever wished you would come true, that empty space in the center of your soul would be filled and your heart would finally know gladness. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? And so do you. And you. In fact, I'm guessing that most of you here knows exactly what that feels like, because many of you have looked in a mirror and asked God, why am I even here? Maybe you're not happy because instead of following your own heart every day, you climb out of bed to try to fill someone else's shoes, to walk a path that is not your own. And with each step taken, a little piece of you just disappears. You don't know how to stop disappearing. You just know you're not holding your shining star. And it eats away at you day by day in some small or not so small way. I couldn't wait to leave Waxahachie, Texas. My flesh crawled from the smallness. I ain't kidding you. When I stepped on board that train, I tried hard to not look back. But I couldn't help myself. My family was standing there waving to me. Remember Eloise? Eloise, that's my sister. Thanks to Jim Crow laws, I never forgot that ride north. Never forgot the suffocating stench of urine and human waste that filled the rail car. See, Negroes had to ride in the car where the toilet was. I never forgot the sight of grown men lowering their eyes to avoid a white man's sneer as he walked past. Still, I was proud to be there. We were all proud because we were headed to better days. Opportunities up north, that's what the newspapers promised. I stepped off that train into fresh air and a brand new day. From the moment I stood on that platform, I knew I'd come to the right place. It was a great place to be. I even owned my own chili parlor and found lots of work. My favorite job was being a manicurist at the White Sox barbershop. I made good money, too. Most of my customers were men. I tell them they had big, strong hands. I'd smile and they'd tip generously. You can't lose telling a man he got big hands. Too bad it wasn't that easy to convince them that they could fly a plane. The sky would be full of them. Still, I never had a job that satisfied me. I always wanted to do something different, something spectacular, something that wouldn't matter. And then one day while sitting around in the barbershop reading, I came across an article in a magazine about Harriet Quimby, a female aviator, a white woman flying a plane. For a minute, I couldn't believe it because from what I'd seen in my lifetime, their men kept them on a very short leash. Still, that article was enough to give me the buzz. That's it. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be an aviatrix. It was the first time in all my life that I felt completely alive, the kind of excitement that makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck. I couldn't stop grinning. In that instant, I caught a glimpse of my very own shiny star. I started going everywhere. I heard that they teach people to fly, and they all promptly slammed the door in my face. They all have the same old tired story. We don't take colors or we don't take women. This was not going to be easy. No, no, not one bit. But all that did was make me push harder. I read every book I could find on aeronautics. I wanted to know everything about flying and everything about everybody who was flying. I was so caught up in the possibilities that I never stopped to think about who I was or where I was. I was a black woman in America. And America sure was not open-minded when it came to the advancement of blacks on any scale, let alone the unexplored skies. There was one place left. I had nothing to lose. When I walked in that door, to my surprise, the receptionist, she looked up at me and smiled. "May I help you?" she said. And then she went on to say, "Oh, you must be the new cleaning girl. Oh, you're so much prettier than the last one that came over. We had to let her go. Whole thing looked like a monkey. She was scaring folks away." All this she said with that smile that now looked twisted and grotesque to me. "No," I answered. "I'm here to apply for the courses to learn to fly." Now the smile faded and her lips perched like someone had just squeezed a fresh lemon into it. Her eyes narrowed down into tiny little paper slits. "Well, we don't have any openings," she said. I was just about to leave when I heard her mumbling up underneath her breath, "Uppity sand-colored niggas, they're the worst kind." I stood there for a moment with my hand trembling violently on the knob. Suddenly, an uncontrollable rage that felt as hot lava must feel began to rise to the top of my throat. I thought about my mama, what she told us over and over when we were kids. They can't make you what you ain't. With renewed determination, I spun to face her. I walked from that door, stood in front of her desk, looked her squarely in the eyes, and I said, my name is Bessie Coleman. Bessie Coleman. Don't you ever forget that name. You hear me? And someday, I will soar over this building and your petty ignorance like I was born with wings. Because I refuse. You hear me? I refuse to take no for an answer. Then, like the queen I knew I was, I left her sitting there, pale and speechless. Now, I felt liberated having said all those things. Still, I was angry. I wanted someone to explain to me once and for all what they were so afraid of. That next day, I came to see you, Mr. Abbott. For those of you who don't know, Mr. Abbott is the founder and editor of the Chicago Weekly Defender. Oh, he was like a father listening to his child as I went on and on about the injustices that I'd been suffering. Shucks, when I turned to see that big old sign on the wall that read, American Race Prejudice Must Be Destroyed, I sure did feel like a child. But he didn't treat me that way, though. No. When I laid out my case about how important it was for a woman of the race to fly, he actually saw me. It might sound silly, but to me, it was as though I was being seen and heard for the first time in my whole life. You told me to learn to speak French, and I did. You told me that France would be kinder to me, that the people would respect my desire to become an aviator, and that they would teach me. 1919, France was 1,000 worlds away from where my life began. When I first arrived, I just stood on the dock, taking in the sights and the sounds as people pushed past me. Everything was foreign, the language, the smell in the air, even the sound of their laughter. Unfortunately, it wasn't the best time to be there either. Signs of war were everywhere. The Germans had left their mark. Thousands and thousands of Frenchmen died in battle defending their country, leaving behind widows, fatherless children, and old folks to fend for themselves. Looking around, it occurred to me that I had a real knack for choosing choppy times to travel and start new adventures. I'd left Texas in 1915 during the race war that started when D.W. Griffith put out that filthy propaganda movie, Birth of a Nation. Lynchings were rampant around the country. In 1919, at the height of the horrible Red Summer riots, I knocked on doors looking for instructors while Chicago was practically at war, and now I travel all the way around the world to study in a country with ashes still smoldering from its own war. There was no turning back. I returned to America in 1921, the first female black pilot in the world. In the world. And the first black pilot, male or female, to have an international license to fly. I wish I could stand here and tell you that it was all clear skies from that point on, that my struggles were over and everyone embraced me. Oh, no, the truth is much more colorful than that. Like the so-called movie producers who claimed they wanted to make a movie picture all about me and my accomplishments, it was to be called Shadow and Sunshine. I never knew who would play Sunshine, but I had a pretty good idea who'd be playing the shadow. But it was even worse than I thought. These Negroes actually wanted me to play a poor girl who couldn't speak proper English or knew her left foot from her right. I was to portray a barefoot runaway. I couldn't control my laughter or my rage toward them. You should have seen the looks on their stupid faces when I said, moi, do you know who I am? Je m'appelle Bessie Coleman. You idiots, I just returned from Berlin, where I flew a German plane with 220 horsepower over Kaiser's Palace. I've studied in France, Holland, and Amsterdam. I was a guest at the home of Anthony H.G. Falker. You ever hear him? Of course not. Now I suggest that you stick your movie script in a shadowy place where the sun don't shine. Then I walked out of that office quicker than I'd walked in it. They hated me for not allowing them to use my name to make some Uncle Tom film that would further embarrass our race. Yes, they hated me, and I didn't care. Enough was enough. You got to draw the line somewhere, people. You hear what I'm saying to you? We as a people have got to be strong enough to draw the line somewhere. And we women, we got to draw two lines. And that goes for all women. Don't make a bit of difference what race or color you are. I grew up hearing black and white men folks saying you got to keep them barefoot in the winter and pregnant in the summertime. Now I ask you, what kind of nonsense is that? If all women know how to do is cook, clean, and sew, who in the world will take care of the children if something terrible happens to their daddy? Strangers? No. The better we are for ourselves, the better we are for our families. Now, that's the way that I was raised. Well, it's time. It's time for me to get going. But it's just this one last thing. You need to hear this. Never let anyone limit you or kill your dream. Never. When they, whoever they may be, begin to plant the seed of failure in your mind and the fear of success in your heart, you must recognize that and run. Run as fast and as far as you can until you find yourself a place to be, a place where you can say to yourself over and over again that it's not true, where you can say, I can do it. I can do anything anyone else in this world can do. As long as God keeps breath in my body, I can do anything. And when you're feeling stronger, after you fed your mind the food of good thought, go back and face them with dignity and courage, knowing that they can't hurt you unless you let them. Blackout. Hello, Leslie. This is Madeline McRae. Hello?
Can you hear me?
No, I can hear you.
I'm far away. I'm sorry. I was telling you that I was listening intensely, so intense I didn't take my phone off of mute. Excellent. I mean, it was just excellent. I mean, it was as if Bessie was here in living color. Let's start off by just asking you, do you want to first tell the audience who you are and how you got involved with Bessie? I know you have a long biography.
And I can't stand talking about myself. I am an actress and a writer. I've produced theater, and let's go with Bessie. I learned about Bessie Coleman back in around 1986. I'd never heard of her, and a friend of mine, also an actor, said to me, you know, you can't depend on Hollywood to hire you, to give you a job. You're a black actress, and the roles just aren't there, not quality roles. So why don't you create something for yourself? Why don't you do something, you know, from one of our heroes from history? And he mentioned Bessie Coleman, and that she was the first female black aviator. And that really, really intrigued me, so much so that I immediately went out and started to try to do some research, and I couldn't find a thing on her when I first started researching. I did come across a couple of articles. It was actually the same article at a public library that had been run in 1977 in Essence and Ebony magazine, but literally couldn't find anything. So I started crafting from imagination and what I read in the article, but it didn't sit well with me. I didn't feel that I was honoring her. It didn't feel authentic.
I have to ask you two questions. Sure. One, when you answer this, the question, just give us your website. And the first question is, why did you ever ask him, why did he pick Bessie out of all the people he thought you should create a one woman play on. Why did Bessie come to mind?
Well, because nothing was out there about her. That was the main reason. It was because she was one of our unsung heroes, or sheroes, if you will. He'd been familiar with Bessie Coleman for a very long time, and just felt that it was time that someone focused on a story about her.
Okay. And your
now
website,
you mentioned
before we
about,
continue.
Say that again about the website.
Your website. So people can visit
website,
your website.
Oh, my website is www.madelinemcrae.com. That's MadelineMcCray.com.
Okay. Now continue. You were talking about the magazines and everything that you gathered, all the resources.
I started writing a script, and then I put it down. It didn't feel authentic. I felt too much creative license with a life that had actually been among us and contributed something very important to society in general, and certainly to the black race. And then out of my frustration, I mentioned it to someone that I couldn't find anything on her, and someone said, "Have you tried the Schomburg Center for Research on Black Culture?" And it was one of those duh moments for me. It always makes me laugh because I hadn't thought of the Schomburg, and I was born across the street from the Schomburg, although many years before there was a Schomburg Center, but I was aware that this wonderful library was there, and I don't have any clue. I didn't live in the neighborhood anymore, so I didn't even think of the Schomburg, but the bottom line is that when I went there and I spoke with the librarian, they took me over to their machine where I looked up her information on microfilm, and I can't even describe to you how much joy it gave me. It felt like I hit lotto because there was all of this information about this woman. There were letters that she had exchanged with family members. There were a few articles, the interviews that she'd given in one or two papers. When she came back from overseas. And so I truly got a sense of who Bessie Coleman really was. I mean, I already knew that she was pretty amazing. You had to be amazing to have the courage in that day and age to decide that you wanted to do something and to be a woman and to be a black woman and to say, I can do this, and I want to fly. Aviation was new. It was a brand new industry. And yet, she was such a visionary that she understood that that was an industry that was going to be a part of the future. And so her goal and her dream wasn't just about learning to fly so that she could go, "Wow, look at me, world. I am an aviatrix. Look what I did." She truly, truly wanted to open a school to teach other blacks to fly because she did have that struggle. No one did. I mean, imagine, she was born in Texas. Her parents were sharecroppers. They picked cotton. And we're talking her, what, she was born in 1892. So, you know, from a cotton field to board a ship, to learn a new language, you know, to travel to another country. It was amazing. It just really was amazing. And so honoring her spirit, it became very, very important to me. And that is why I wrote the play.
Throughout your research, Madeline, were you able to meet any of her descendants?
Yeah. I got to tell you, that was one of the best moments for me. That's beyond Tony Nennett for me, because I'll tell you, when the U.S. Postal Service released her commemorative stamp, I don't know if you remember, but there was a stamp in their Heritage series, and they flew me out to Chicago which is where they were doing the unveiling. And so her family members were there. And her niece, her nephew, Marion and Arthur, who at the time were in their 80s. So I did this, and, you know, and of course there were some younger family members there as well, but the thing about Marion and Arthur in particular is that they literally spent time with their aunt. They lived with her just for a spell when she took a break from all of her efforts to become to get her own school. And so they knew her, and in fact, her nephew Arthur became a pilot himself because of the imagery of his aunt. And so when I performed for them, and, you know, for the audience in general, but the greatest compliment of all, and I've gotten some really, really great endorsements for this work from others, but this one was very special to me, and it remains so today, was that her niece Marion said to me, "How did you do that? Because you have her mannerisms, the way she held her hand, certain gestures. That's her." And so all I could say to her was, I always pray before I perform. I ask her to be with me, to literally guide me through that performance. So if it is a spiritual connection, that is certainly something and the only reason that I could give to that. But so yeah, it was great meeting her family. I'd say about 10 years now, and I haven't been in touch with any of them since that time. But I do intend to reach out to them shortly.
Now, did they give you a tour of her hometown, and were you able to actually touch and feel any of her artifacts?
No. This performance was at the Disabled. Or the disabled, one or the other, you pronounce that in Chicago. And there, to my knowledge, there in Chicago, I mean, there's a street there on the way to the airport named Bessie Coleman Way. I could see that, of course, leaving the airport. But I was not able to do some of the things that I would have liked to have done at that time, because it blew me into that one day or 2 days that I was there.
Now, you mentioned the stamp. Is there any other commemorative places or markers or anything that we can visit to learn more about Bessie?
Well, you know, there's some wonderful exhibits about her, like the Smithsonian Air and Space has a nice exhibit of her. There's another airport, but I think that's more or less just a really nice mural of her. But there are some, and there is a website. There is an official Bessie Coleman website, which I have nothing to do with. So one could also Google that. I think it's BessieColeman.com. And you'll probably find some information there and even see some photographs. That I was on that site not too long ago, and I saw a couple of really lovely photographs that I didn't see before.
Now,
so
if someone
try that, the BessieColeman.com, and I think you can find some stuff there.
Now, for teachers, educators, churches, nonprofits, if they want to get in touch with you for a performance, how would they go about it?
They could email me. They could certainly, you know, go to my website, and they can also email me at Madeline, that's Madeline, M-A-D-E-L-I-N-E, at MadelineMcCray.com. So it's Madeline at MadelineMcCray.com. No spaces anywhere. And if you Google me, also my number comes up as well.
Wonderful. Now, I know you recently performed at the Schomburg. You want to talk a little bit about?
Yeah, I'd love to. The material, the show, that was very special, and the reason it was special because it was coming home, and actually being able to perform in the very place where I was able to get the information that became the first version. I have two versions of this piece now. I've been performing the one act of it for years, and we recently expanded it to a two-act play. So what on April the 30th, that was a very special day. That was the day that Bessie actually died from a plane accident, when she actually fell out of the plane while she was preparing to do an exhibition flight the following day. So April the 30th, I wanted to honor her memory and her achievements. And we combined that with an event to demonstrate the power of the human spirit to have challenges and to overcome those challenges. And the event itself is based on an initiative that I recently formed called Each One Rock One, the Women's Empowerment Project. And we had a panel discussion right after my performance. There was a panel discussion, The Art of Living a Life Worth Dying For. And the panel discussion was myself, Terry Williams, a very, very dear friend of mine, and a mental health advocate, and a publicist many, many people might know, your audience might know who Terry Williams is. She's an incredible community activist and public relations guru. And we worked together on a number of projects, and we decided to come together on this specific project because of the work that she does in the mental health field and combining the arts and issues of overcoming critical circumstances in the community, like women who are battered and abused and children who are abused. And we had on our panel, we had two psychologists, one Dr. Cynthia Grace, who is with Harlem Hospital, a detective John Ramos, who was there to address safety issues, how to report violent crime. And the three panelists that joined us, very special to both Terry and myself, one being Jason Davis. Jason is a member of the Bloods, but he is an anti-violence advocate and activist. And Brianna Michelle she is now a fashion model. She's been in Essence magazine. She's been all over Europe in her dream. And another young man who is an HIV AIDS awareness advocate. His name is Prince Raja. And each and every one of these. And we also had another other panelist was there from a political standpoint, which was Roy Paul, and he was there to talk about the Republican war on women. So the theme of this was basically about having challenges and struggles and overcoming those challenges and struggles. Each one of the young people that was on the panel had been victims of child abuse and molestation, and yet they've taken their lives into a complete different direction. And not that they weren't still in pain, but they had that will, and they had that strength, and they had that power. And I thought that that was a great way to connect what Bessie stood for.
If Bessie was alive, if Bessie was alive and sitting on that panel, what do you think she would want to say?
I think that she would have been. She would say, as she said then, as she felt then, I think she would have said, you're doing the right thing, you're on the right path, that you should never let anything get in your way, that wherever you start your life does not determine where your life will end, that there is always room for growth, and that you must always stay focused, keep your eye on the prize, and reach deep inside yourself, and always strive to be the very best human being that you can be. And don't let anyone block your dreams. I really think that that would be her message if she were on that panel.
Wonderful. Now, you mentioned in your piece that she wanted to open up a school.
Did she ever fulfill her dream?
You know, that's, she was very, very close to getting there at the time of her death. She had finally settled down in Florida with a very, very nice family. And they were getting her, they had convinced her to take a different route, because what she had been doing was touring the country. She was speaking in lectures, and she was trying to raise this money on her own. She didn't have benefactors. And so this couple was going to help her. Put a structure in place so that that leg of her dream would be realized. So she was much, much closer to it, but she actually never got a chance to open the doors to her own school. But her story is so amazing. So much of her life is so amazing that that is the area in which has been picked up by others.
Wonderful. Now, are there any schools, African-American-owned schools, that exist in your research that you found?
Say that once again. Sorry.
Have you found any African-American schools, pilot schools, avionics schools, aeronautical schools?
There are not schools so much, but programs.
Okay.
There are several around the country now. It actually was able to perform for a Black Aviators group a number of years ago. So there are a number of them. If one were to Google Black Aviators and Black schools, aviation schools, you come up with a lot of variations, but not, you know, it's not like, you know, we're saturated with them, but there are schools available, private run schools that I'm aware of.
And I think, I know there was one in New Jersey, I think the gentleman died, but he was out of East Orange. So her dream,
you know,
is,
what, if he was a minister, do you happen to know if he was a minister?
I think
because
he was. I learned, I met him in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
Early in 91, I was in my early 20s. So
I think that if it's the same gentleman, and it was, I do remember it being East Orange, and he was a minister, and he saw me perform somewhere, and he approached me, and he said, I have a school, I teach boys to fly, and he told me about how it helped them academically. How their grades had improved. Once they flew, they just knew they could do anything. So his work was very important to him. And he invited me. He said, you have to come to my church to perform. And I did. I just don't remember the name of the church, or him at this moment, because, my God, it's got to be at least 15 years ago.
And he was he elderly at the time?
Yeah, I don't know if I should call him elderly. My God, I'm in my 50s now. So he probably was in his 60s. At that time. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. That's probably the same gentleman. We'll do research, and I'll make sure I'll post the information on Facebook and on everything else. How have you been received? There have been peaks and valleys. The economy has affected everyone. Let us know how your performance has been received. Are you getting a lot more interest and is the audience changing? The demographics changing?
Well, you know, the thing is, I really think that actually my lack of bookings would have more to do with my not having been aggressively pursuing them. I was always very well received. When people know about the show, when they know about my performance, I've been very fortunate that way. But I did take some time off. I just also recently wrote a book called Healthy Women Rock, How to Live the Life You Desire and Deserve, Lose Weight and Control Negative Thoughts. Co-authored the book with my son, Tarasha, who's a fitness and nutrition expert. So in the midst of doing a number of other projects, I had not, really been out there pushing for the show, but I do intend to get it back up and out. The other day was actually the first time that I performed in quite some time, but I'm, definitely interested if someone would like to get in touch with me to book, a performance, just get in touch with me and, as long as it works with my schedule, we'll make it happen.
Right. Because I know that President Obama is now having this initiative with the Science, Technology, Engineering, Math, STEM. And I think what you're doing falls in line with what's going on around the country, a trend. So I hope that people listening, educators, math, science, engineers, listening to the show, will take down your website and contact you. I think you'll help out in more ways than one.
If I can just say that one of the things that I really wanted to be inclusive of in this show, the response to it age range wise is, you know, it's pretty much always the same. I get I've performed in front of Tuskegee Airmen who said, you know, said how inspiring it was for them. I've performed for younger children who said that they felt, you know, as though I'd lifted them and made them think more about what they were capable of doing. And some of the language is very, very specific towards that end, to really have the audience, whatever audience that is, to listen and hear a little bit about something that's within themselves. A dream is a dream is a dream. And courage is courage. And so it's set in a way to inspire, to motivate, and to elevate, make people aware of what's inside themselves, as well as to teach history in that way. So I love that from that perspective.
Great. Now, you mentioned your son in your book. We'll talk about that. Your book, what inspired you to write this book, and where can we purchase it?
Well, the inspiration for writing it is we want to help. We see that this book is for women primarily, but when I say it's for women, as an extension, once a woman is healthy, the entire family and the entire community is well. Women have a tendency, we have a tendency to put ourselves last and to not take the best care of ourselves. We're running around and we're trying to do for everybody else. So this book is deliberately written to encourage women to take better care of ourselves. I mean, we start with mind, change your mind, change your body, change your life and your finances. Our health.
Was there one incident, or, you know, did you see someone, or did someone and your family suffer from obesity? Did you have an epiphany?
As an African American, many people in my family, are overweight, or were overweight. A lot of my elderly relatives have gone on now. But yes, there was that. But my own mother passed away when I was 15 years old, and she was just a mere 40 at the time, herself, 39 going on 40. And she died of a heart attack. And at the time, I mean, I didn't know anything about these issues. As an adult, of course, I've, you know, thought back on them, and I'm looking at what's happening in our society, the level of stress that there are. So a lot of people who are very close to me have health problems, yes, and that really concerns me. And by extension, what's going on with, you know, women's health and just health in general in the African American community, let's face it. There's way behind the time in terms of fitness. My son has been fitness expert since 1995. He wasn't an expert then, but that's when he began his journey along that path, and he's stayed there. He switched from television communication. His degree is actually in television communications, and he switched over to wellness courses because he too understood what it means to have a holistic life as opposed to where we are with our health and our lack of good health and wellness. So it's got to change. I sound like I'm dabbling a little bit because there's just so much that I want to say about that issue. But it's just really to empower and to encourage and to inspire women to really take a really good look at what we do to ourselves, to break the bad habits.
Well, you're not babbling. Give us three great tips that you think everyone must know about before you hang up tonight.
Okay.
As far as health and wellness.
First and foremost, we have to pay attention to our mental health. Everything starts in the mind with our thoughts. If we're sick there, everything else is going to eventually fall apart. So we have to control that. We have to take a look at what we're eating, what we're putting in our bodies, the nutrition that we're not getting. And we have to make sure that we are getting proper exercise. It can't be stressed enough. And our sisters that, and it's a difficult subject, but because our sisters who are overweight feel as though they're being attacked or discriminated against when we bring up this subject. But it's not about that. It's about the health aspect. So it's not like everybody has to be skinny. You just have to be healthy, and you have to get in shape. It's about shape, not weight. So,
but if they buy the book, you know, the book is Healthy Women Rock, How to Live the Life You Desire and Deserve. There's a lot of stuff. I've got life experiences of my own in the book. I talk about my mother's death in the book. There's information about depression in the book because Terry Williams, whose book is Black Pain, It Just Looks Like We're Not Hurting, wrote the foreword for the book, and there is an intro to her book inside of Healthy Women Rock as well. And, of course, Tarashi, it gives the information and guidance as it applies to nutrition and fitness. And I talk about finances and how we have to empower ourselves by becoming financially independent. The world has changed. It will never be the same again. So we have to be more creative if we want to be free spiritually, mentally, and financially. So
is there a correlation between unhealthy diets and habits and the economy and economical?
The healthcare costs. I mean, it's absolutely. I mean, the amount of emergency room visits that will never ever be paid for because people are sick and they're out of. Of course, it impacts us all across the board. And you know, you have to think about it. People who are trying to hold on to their jobs if they still have their jobs. When you're unhealthy, you're not as creative. You're not as productive. Things aren't getting done that you really want to get done. So our health is everything. It's
right. Everything.
But so we have to do that.
Is there a healthy diet, healthy food available to the poor community? You know, there's a McDonald's on every block in urban communities versus markets with fresh foods and vegetables.
I know.
So,
the access... And yes, you're right. Yes, there certainly isn't. There aren't enough healthy places in poor communities. But
you could supersize a meal, right? You could supersize a McDonald's meal, and it'll cost cheaper than buying a fresh apple or fresh, bag of fruit.
There's no question about that. There's no question about it. At the same time, there are also salads in McDonald's. So we have to take.
Yeah. Yeah. Recently, they are changing, and that's
yes, what they are. They are changing that, and so we have to look for that. And I know that it is very, very, very hard, right? But the one thing that we definitely have to do is that we have to take personal responsibility for our health. We can. It's not. I'm not saying that McDonald's is good or bad. I'm saying that there are other choices, and if you got to get on the train or you got to go someplace else, somehow. You can get into that grocery store. It's better to buy a bag of beans and to get the rice, some brown rice, and to cook the beans and rice. And we know we don't have a problem understanding how to season food. See, I'm not the one to talk about cooking, but I can say that there's a lot of protein in beans, and it's cheaper to go and buy a bag of beans and to cook a pot for your family in your home than it is to go out to spend that money at McDonald's anyway. But if you're going to go to McDonald's, then choose a salad or don't supersize your meat. Don't do that. Just because it's there doesn't mean that we have to do that. I personally don't eat McDonald's.
I'm surprised. I'm joking with you. I said I'm surprised, but I'm just being facetious. But there is also a trend of these co-ops in urban areas, and I see, you know, things are changing.
Mm-hmm.
Have you witnessed any changes in trends as far as the sustainability and more people bringing farms and products into the city?
You know, there are some changes. There aren't nearly enough, but there are some changes taking place in the community. And the grocery stores, do in the majority of them, do we have the greatest of your fresh vegetables and fruits? No. But yet, I can't say that it, and it, of course, this doesn't mean all communities, because that's such a broad, broad thing. Like, I've been walking around in Harlem for the last 3 weeks, right? And I see so much more there now than there was before in terms of what's available healthy. Even some of the, you know, of our smaller health food stores. I went into one of the health food stores just yesterday, as a matter of fact, and purchased a delicious sandwich for $3.99. And, you know, and this is not vegan, but it was vegetarian. But it was very, very tasty. So we got to look for stuff. And all I can say, Leslie, is that personal responsibility. Personal responsibility. If you got to go those extra steps, because believe me, I know when there's some junk, or when I hear about these crowds that are, you know, standing online to get the newest pair of $600 sneakers or $700 sneakers, Macy's is downtown or wherever these new stores are. I hate to, you know, to sound crass like that, but we get to where we want to when it's something that we do want. And generally, it's something that isn't going to have any sustainable value for our lives.
Right.
So when
and last question.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No. So I'm just saying that we have to take personal responsibility. We have to know that we have to do better by ourselves. And so if we've got to find a way to get somewhere else to do it. And not only that, though, but to really stay on the local politicians and force them to create the kind of opportunity that will bring the stores into the neighborhood where it can be affordable to the community. So there is a responsibility to get on top of the politicians about that. So it's not just, you know, you getting on a train. It's bigger than that.
And the last question I have is, I know they changed the law. They passed the law where the schools could no longer sell fattening food in the vending machine.
Good.
Food, you know, fattening food, unhealthy food. Are you aware of that at all?
I think that's absolutely the best way that, you know, the best thing that they could have done. And it's not just in the school. Parents have got to realize what's in those cereals. It's nothing but pure sugar. And it's all fattening. It's all fattening. It's why we have children running, and because we have children now who are more sedentary in that they're sitting down playing video games and you don't see them running up and down the street like they did when I was a kid, probably when you were younger as well. So now, you know, when you've got all of these unhealthy foods coming at you, the sodas and the sweets, those things have to be cut out. So whatever one can cut out of bringing into the house, again, back to personal responsibility. And they can go to the hospital in their area. They have courses. They have workshops to teach you what is healthy and what's not healthy. And so we've got to get more proactive in terms of getting out there. This is a great conversation. You'd love to talk to Tarache about this.
I'm going to invite him on the show. I definitely will. And Michelle Obama, if you could give her your book, and if she was on the line right now, what would you say to convince her to purchase your book?
What would I say what?
To Michelle Obama about your book.
I might not say anything to her about my book. I would thank her from the bottom of my heart for having the courage and the foresight to put together the initiative that she's put together to save the lives of children around this country, to really make obesity the number one priority for her message as First Lady of the United States of America. That would be what I would want her to do. I would give her Healthy Women Rock as a gift. And if she, you know, would want a copy, I would love to have her have one. But most importantly, for her to use her position and her voice to make these kinds of changes, I can say nothing but great things to this woman. Nothing. We owe her.
Well, I enjoyed talking to you. You know that. We've had several conversations prior to this interview. And
yes.
I hope you had a good time. And I would like everyone...
Ball.
I hope that everyone that's listening will go out and purchase your book, go to your website, and let's give it to them one more time and give them some parting words.
Sure. Thank you, thank you, thank you, every one of you who are on this call. I truly hope that you learned something about Bessie Coleman that you didn't know. I hope that you see something, or heard something, rather, that you'll be able to use in your own life. If you go to Amazon.com or to buy Healthy Women Rock, that would be great. If you want to buy it from my website, again, it's www.MadelineMcCrae. Oh, I'm sorry. Yep, you can't get it at that website. You can get it at www.HealthyWomenRock.com. That's also my website. Or you can get it from Amazon.com, and that is a love story for your listeners, because it's all about them and all about you out there. So, and Leslie, thank you so, so much for giving me the opportunity to be on your show.
Thank you. We're definitely going to have your son back on, and we'll talk.
Thank you, ma'am. All right. You have a wonderful evening.
You too. Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you. Same to you, Leslie. Thank you. Bye. And just say Happy Mother's Day to your listeners. Bye-bye.
Great. All righty.